Father, thank you for your word tonight. We thank you for this time together. Thinking about Lori, Father, pray that she has a wonderful time with her daughter, that she gets home safely, Father. And just bless our time tonight. Be glorified in it, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, if you would turn, please, to the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel. Now, if you want to just look up here, we'll have it up here for you. But if you want to look in your Bible, Ezekiel chapter 8. Pastor Steve, this is a Bible study. Yeah. So Ezekiel chapter 8. Now, you're probably wondering why I didn't have you turn to Ezekiel chapter 10, because that's where we left off last time. We were talking about the glory of Israel. And the reason, the glory of Israel departing, the reason that we are in Ezekiel chapter 10 is after, as I was preparing for tonight's Bible study, the reason we're in Ezekiel chapter 8. Thank you, Phil. Put your head on your desk, please. Okay. The reason we're in Ezekiel chapter 8 is because as I was thinking about it and looking at these passages, I realized that I was shortchanging you guys. And what I mean by that is this. I jumped right to Ezekiel chapter 10, which deals specifically with what we want to deal with in our study, the departure of the glory of God from Israel. The problem is, this is one of the richest passages in all of the Old Testament. It is just truly one of the astonishing passages. And it begins in Ezekiel chapter 8, and it goes all the way to Ezekiel chapter 11. And so what I've decided to do is, since we're not in a sprint, we're in a marathon, right? What I've decided to do is we're going to begin with Ezekiel chapter 8, and I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. And I also want to give you a fair warning, that I'll get as far as I can with this tonight, but you will see some of these things again on Sunday morning, because I've really been convicted, especially about some of the passages in this particular chapter, and some of the things I heard today from Franklin Graham, just thinking about the state of our country, the difficult times in which we're living, and the importance of meekness. And so a part of this will play in. It certainly won't be the whole sermon, but I will look at this. So just a fair warning, if you want to stay home on Sunday, God will do bad things to you, but, you know, it's up to you. It's not for me to tell you what to do. But let's take a look at this now. I want to look at this entire section as a whole, rather than just kind of come into the middle of it. Because when we come into Ezekiel chapter 10, we're right in the middle of a vision. And Ezekiel gets this vision from the Lord. A vision is not a dream. And a vision is not a literal occurrence. So he is transported to Jerusalem and God shows him things, but his body is still in Babylon. He's not being physically transported anywhere. But what's amazing about this vision and all of Ezekiel chapter 8 all the way to 11 is one vision. That's why I say it's really kind of shortchanging you by not giving you the full richness of this. There's no reason not to. It's so incredibly amazing. Some of the most astonishing things in the entire Old Testament are in these chapters. It really is incredible. I mean, these things will preach all day long. They're very, very powerful. So he is in exile. Ezekiel is in exile. He is one of the prophets, or one of the young men who was taken captive when the Babylonians came in and captured Jerusalem and took many of the Israelites back into Babylon. That happened in three separate waves, the most important being 586 BC when the city was destroyed completely. This is the beginning of the Babylonian exile. So Ezekiel had repeatedly told us, if you read like the first seven chapters of Ezekiel, which we're not going to go back that far, but you know, one other thing I want to tell you before we get going in this, I've never been able to teach these things as a unit. I've certainly taught some parts of it, like the chambers of imagery, but and the departing of the glory of God, but I've never taught all four of these chapters like this. So I'm very excited about it. It's something I have not had the privilege of being able to do. So if you read the first seven chapters of Ezekiel, you see that Ezekiel is repeatedly explaining that judgment is the judgment that is coming against the people of God is coming because of their sin. That God is going to reward them because of the sin. It's not very different than what we studied for many hours in Jeremiah, you know, where Jeremiah was warning of the impending doom of walking away from God. But the question is, there's a terrible judgment coming, but what had the people done? I mean, is it really that bad? Like, you know, what had they done that is so unbelievably offensive to God that he's going to bring a judgment? And the judgment that he brings is will cause you to quake because it is so complete. And I spent, on one verse alone, I spent hours trying to find somebody who could soften this verse for me in Ezekiel chapter 9, and I could find no one. Because he's going to call for the death of men, old men, young men, older women, young virgins, and children. And it's a very difficult thing to hear. And we don't like to think about things like this. We don't like to think about God's judgment coming upon those that we consider to be innocent. And some of the most difficult questions that we have in studying the Bible are questions that come against genocide and how, you know, what this means. And so I'm going to try to put it together for you. I've done a lot of thinking about this one verse in particular. I'm not going to be able to soften it for you because it's not soft. But I think we might be able to come to understand it a little bit better, and to maybe get a sense of the awesomeness of what God is trying to show us in that passage. But we're not there yet. What did they do that was so terrible? What is it that the children of Israel did that was so terrible that such a judgment is about to come upon the population? And God is going to answer that question. God is going to answer the question for Ezekiel while Ezekiel is sitting in his living room talking to men who have come to inquire of him, probably about the judgments that are about to take place in Israel. They're probably asking the questions that God is going to answer for Ezekiel in a vision while he's sitting right in their midst. None of them are going to see this vision, but he's going to see it. He receives it while he's sitting with them. And he's going to see the most amazing things. Now, there's an important point of application that I want you to tack to the back of your mind while we're studying this. And that is, a lot of this has to do with the temple. I want you to always make the transition of the Old Testament temple being the place where God dwelt and the New Testament temple being the place where God dwells. We are the temple of God. And when God would not tolerate idolatry in his temple in the Old Testament, he will not tolerate idolatry in the temple in the New Testament either. Are you with me? All right? So let's keep that in the back of our minds. So God is going to answer this question. The vision that we see in Ezekiel chapter 8 through 11 is one single unit with four specific parts. The first part we're going to see, God is confronting the wickedness of the people. He's going to show the reasons why this terrible judgment is going to come. In the second part, he's going to talk about the actual judgment itself, which is horrific. In the third part, Jerusalem is going to be shown as being so wicked that God's glory departs from Israel and does not return until much later. And then finally, chapter 11 is going to wrap up some things and tie the whole thing up into one cohesive whole. So first, let's take a look at chapter 8. Let me read to you the first four verses. First six verses. How about that? In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, I sat in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me. The hand of the Lord fell upon me there. I want you to pay very close attention to the description that Ezekiel gives. And I talked to you a little bit about this last week. He's trying to describe something the best he can that is virtually indescribable. And that's why you have all of the similes. It was like this and like that. And it had the appearance of this. But he's in his house sitting with the elders of Judah. And the Bible says, the hand of the Lord fell upon me there. Then I looked and behold, a form that had the appearance of a man. Below what appeared to be his waist was fire. And above his waist was something like the appearance of brightness, like gleaming metal. He put out the form of a hand, not a hand, the form of a hand. And he took me by the lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the gateway of the inner court that faces the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy. We'll talk about this, which provokes jealousy. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision that I saw in the valley. He's bringing us back to Ezekiel chapter 1 when he had this amazing vision of God's glory. And then he said to me, son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north. So I lifted up my eyes toward the north, and behold, north of the altar gate in the entrance was this image of jealousy. And he said to me, son of man, do you see what they're doing? Great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me far from my sanctuary. But you will see greater abominations. This is how he begins. Why is God's judgment coming upon his people? Why is God judging Jerusalem? They think that because they've got the temple, that they're safe. But God doesn't care about the temple. He cares about the love and devotion that sanctifies the temple. The faith in him that sanctifies the temple. And now the temple is about to be vacant because God is going to leave. Ezekiel mentions the date at the very beginning, verse 1. This adds authenticity to the message. You know, a lot of the prophets do this. They tell you the date, and we're able to establish exactly what year, when this happened, the day of the year that it happened. Of course, it's going by the Jewish calendar, which was a lunar year, 360 days instead of 365 days. But we're able to calculate, it adds authenticity to the message. And it was in the house, as I said, where he was sitting with the elders of Judah that he receives this vision. Most likely they had gone to ask, we don't know this for sure, but it seems reasonable that the vision that God gives Ezekiel is answering the question that the elders had. So they come and they want to know why would God bring his judgment upon Jerusalem? You say God is going to bring his judgment. Why? And then Ezekiel is able to say why, because God gives him this horrific vision. It was when he was sitting in the house that these astonishing things came to him. And Ezekiel is sitting before the elders, and he sees a figure that's like the figure of a man. The figure was a theophany, an appearance of God. The second person of the Trinity. The second person of the Trinity who became Jesus, who was born as a man in John chapter 1 on the real Christmas morning, is the only member of the Trinity that's ever been visible. God appeared in a burning bush. It was a theophany. It's a picture of the believer. Even though there's many trials, fire all outside of the bush, it's not consumed. The believer is not consumed by the trials. he appeared in a pillar of fire and, you know, cloud by day and fire by night. And, you know, from his waist down, Ezekiel sees something like fire. And from there up, his appearance was bright like glowing metal. I don't think he really knows what he's dealing with. His description is very unsure. It's cryptic. I don't think he knows how to describe what he's actually seeing. He didn't want to be accused of describing God as some, just a mere man, or a man who had been glorified. So he's very careful about the way he phrases his description. God does not have a body of a man. His appearance was merely the figure of a man. God does not have an actual hand that is reaching out. He says that he stretched out what looked like a hand. He's trying to make sense of something that he's got no context to describe. It's important to see that this is a vision. It's important to understand that Ezekiel is not going to be literally transported to Jerusalem. His physical body remains in Babylon, right there before the elders, and maybe they just saw him sit back and close his eyes. I don't know what they would have seen, but they certainly didn't see any of this. And it's four chapters of it. This is a vision that passed from Ezekiel, and later he would describe it to the elders. In the vision, Ezekiel is elevated between earth and heaven. He's caught by the, you know, lock of hair and carried up by God, transported, not physically, but spiritually, to Jerusalem. Flown, you know, mystically in a vision from where he was in Babylon to Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, he's standing at the north entrance to the north gate of the inner, the north gate to in the temple of God. So I have a diagram I want to show you, give you a sense of what this is like. This is the layout, not of the tabernacle, but of the temple of Solomon. Okay? You'll notice the brazen altar is in the front. I'm talking about to the east now. The brazen altar is to the east, right? The bronze laver, or the sea, is down there. Down also on the east. And then you have the same basic layout that you had with the tabernacle where the priest would enter into the holy place. You notice there's some extra stuff in there that wasn't in the tabernacle, but the altar of incense is right before the Holy of Holies, and the lampstands are there, the tables for the bread of the presence, the showbread, okay, are in there, and the Ark of the Covenant is in the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. So basically it's the same. Now, there are a number of gates by which you could enter into this temple complex. The one that Ezekiel is going to end up in is the one on the north. Now, show the next slide, if you would, Steve. This might help you a little bit more. The problem with this slide, I really like it, but the problem with this slide is that north is facing east. In your mind, I tried to just flip the image, but it just looked ridiculous. So I just put a big arrow there. Imagine that, you know, flip it, and the arrow is looking down from the north, okay? But here you can see the gate. So you can see there's a gate on the north, a gate on the south, a gate on the east, okay? So think about entering this complex. You go through the outer court, but before you get to the outer court, into the holy place, like the song says, you go through the inner court. So there's an outer court, that's the outer court, and then you go through that, through those other gates, and that's the inner court. The inner court that went around the actual building complex where you would walk into the holy place. Okay, everybody with me so far? All right, Ezekiel is going to land over here on the north. So he is looking into the temple complex from the north. All right, you with me so far? Okay. So he finds himself landing on the north gate of the inner court. So he's through this, he's probably standing in the outer court looking at the gate to the inner court. With me? All right. Now, the north gate was one of three gates that opened from the outer court into the inner court. Since Ezekiel is at the entrance of the north gate, he's probably standing in the outer court, looking south toward the inner court. You with me? On the outer court from the north, looking south. Okay. Beside the north entrance to the inner court, so he's in the, I looked for my flasher and I couldn't find it. He's in this outer court here, looking at the entrance to the inner court, and what he sees must have taken his breath away. He sees an idol that provokes jealousy. It's called an idol of jealousy, or an idol that provokes jealousy. Now, this is obviously a violation of the second commandment. He sees this graven image. Now, remember, God is answering some kind of question for the prophet. Why is judgment coming? It's coming because of idolatry, first and foremost. Okay? Look at the next slide. The second commandment says this. We got that, Steve? Exodus? It's the very, it should be, there you go. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above. Now, hold on, don't move it forward yet, Steve. Or that is on earth beneath, or what is in the water under the earth. Now, God says, listen, you will not make any graven image. You will not worship the image of anything that I've created. So somebody says, oh, the calf. God created the calf. You shall not worship the creature, you shall worship the creator. What does the Bible say about God who demands that none of his creatures be worshipped? Well, this is what he says, and I think this is going to make sense. Go ahead, Steve. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a what? This is the idol, Ezekiel says, that provokes jealousy. It's the jealous idol. Because God sees not only is his people worshiping something other than him, a false god, but can you believe this? They're doing it in the temple. To the Lord, exactly, right. So the Lord is saying, do you see what they're doing? And he asks the rhetorical question to the prophet, do you see what they're doing? Do you see? And then, you know, and it's kind of like, I'm going to make this use common language. He says, you ain't seen nothing yet. He says, you will see greater abominations than this. He's saying, you haven't seen anything. Wait, we're going in. We're going into this complex. Are you able to picture the image? Now, what is this image? This is a big question. It could be a lot of things. It's obviously a violation of the second commandment, and it provokes God to jealousy. We know that. But the god or goddess that is represented isn't identified. But I think we have a pretty good idea who it might be. I think it's Asherah. We spent a lot of time on Asherah when we studied the book of Jeremiah. Now, if I were to take you, and maybe someday we should do this, we ought to do a field trip. I mean, we've been in a good class. Don't you think we ought to do a field trip? I think we ought to go to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, my second home, and I'll take you to the ancient art section and the Babylonian section and the Sumerian section, and I'll show you these little images. And you see they're almost always feminine. And they have exaggerated reproductive organs. So over, you know, exaggerated hips, you know, over-exaggerated breasts. And you wonder, what is this all about? Like, why is it that these ancient... Was this like ancient pornography? Not at all. Not at all. What were these little... what my Aunt Leona would call a bunum. What were these little statues? You know, these little knickknacks. What they were images that invoked the idea of fertility worship. Ancient man, after the fall, and when sin began to have its way in the world, people began to look at the cycles of the seasons. And they would see that at a certain time of year, all the vegetation dies. And then at another time of the year, all of a sudden, everything springs back to life. And they began to weave myths around this. These were called the mystery cults. Asherah was one of these. Asherah was a fertility cult. A part of worshiping Asherah involved sexual licentiousness. And these poles that were set up all over the place were a great perversion of God's creation. Rather than worshiping the God who had created the seasons, they began to deify the seasons themselves. Tammuz, for example, who we're going to hear about in a little bit, fertility cult. The idea was that, and I'll show you how that's a counterfeit of the Christian message. But the idea is, I want to just put in your mind, these Asherah, it's difficult to figure out what they are, because even archaeologists struggle at what they actually looked like, the ones that are mentioned. I'll give you a couple of examples. This is one that was found in Hatzor, which they're almost certain was an Asherah pole. Okay? Next one. This is another artist image, and the idea being it's a pole, but the pole is in the form of a woman, and I'm going to be very, very honest with you folks. This is an image that was made for a Bible dictionary, and it's an X-rated image that has been turned into PG. Okay? They put clothes on this woman. There was no clothes on the Asherah. But the idea being that when, you know, the great kings like Josiah, good King Josiah, who had this incredible cleansing of the land, he destroyed all the Asherah poles, you know, and that they were possibly in the image of the fertility goddess in the shape of a pole, if that makes sense. Here's another. Now, this is one that was actually found, and you'll notice, you'll see, you go to the great museums of the world, you go to the ancient art section, and you will always find these types of images. Notice the exaggerated hips, right? What are the hips all about? The hips are about childbirth, right? This is how children, it's a fertility. How are children nursed? Yeah, see the exaggeration? Okay, and then these that were found, many of them. Next slide, Steve, if you would. These were found. You'll notice in almost every case, the Asherah. These are Asherah that were found all around the Middle East. And you notice that not only is there the exaggeration of the sexual parts of the statue, but they're actually their hands are holding them up like as though they were almost pointing to them. You will find these everywhere. In different places, for example, Babylonian, and the names of the goddesses change from place to place. But the Babylonians, they'll look like Babylonian women, only Asherah. When you go into Canaan, they look like Canaanite women. It's like the faces change, but the religion is the same. The fertility is the same. So it was a worship of these types of cycles that the earth had. Now, you can only imagine how this would have infuriated the God who made the summer, spring, winter, and fall. Not in that order. But you can imagine how God, it's spring, summer, fall, and winter. You can imagine how this must have absolutely infuriated God. So here comes the prophet now. God's answering a question. God's bringing him to the northern gate. He's in the outer court, looking into the inner court. And right there near the gate, in whatever image it happened to be, is one of these idols. Most likely from what we know about this time and the struggles that they had with their idolatry of this time, I would put a week's paycheck that this is the worship of the Canaanite goddess of fertility, Asherah. King Manasseh had placed a carved image of Asherah in the temple during his reign. 2 Kings chapter 21 and verse 7, Deuteronomy 16, 21. But later, he removed it. 2 Chronicles 33, 13 and 15. After Manasseh's death, an Asherah pole found its way back into the temple, but it was removed during Josiah's reforms. We spent hour after hour after hour talking about King Josiah because, you know, you will remember that Jeremiah served under five kings. And he was a great king, an amazing king. And he removed the Asherah pole. He burned it in the Kidron Valley outside of Jerusalem in the hope of eradicating this idolatrous worship forever. Unfortunately, after Josiah's untimely death, you remember he died in battle, going into battle. There was a great mourning in the land after he died. The people returned to their idolatry. Evidently, a new Asherah pole found its way into the place where the one that had been destroyed had been removed from. And God is showing this to the prophet. As Ezekiel stares at this idol, beside him is the glory of the God of Israel. God's moral outrage is expressed in the rhetorical question. Do you see what they are doing? Let me answer the question for you. Why Jerusalem is destroyed. Do you see what they're doing? God will never share his glory with an idol. God will never share his temple with an idol. And we are the temples of God. And idolatry is putting anything in the temple or the temple being occupied with anything that is above God. And it can be a good thing, like our family, like our kids. Or it can be a bad thing, like pornography. Or some sin that we refuse to deal with. And you know what God is saying? You know what? Go ahead, don't deal with it. I'll deal with it. That's what this whole chapter is about. It's interesting. When the judgment comes, the judgment begins at the temple and radiates out from the temple into the community. Because those who are in the temple should have known better. And this corresponds perfectly to Peter, who says, if judgment, now is the end. Well, how does it go? Now the end of all things is at hand. And if judgment begins, let it begin in the house of God. We know better. The world doesn't. There was a guy at the Billy Graham rally today walking around with a sign protesting Billy Graham. He said, I don't even know what it meant. What would Jesus say? I don't even get the question. But the point is, you can't get mad at a guy like that. He's lost. He's lost. You're not. You say, I can't believe the way sinners sin. I can't believe the way saints sin. What do you expect a sinner to do? What do you expect a sinner that's never met Christ, that has no sense of godliness, no sense of how deeply his or her sin has offended the true and living God, whose entire life is a life of idolatry? What do you expect someone like that to do? I'll tell you what God expects his children to do. Be ye therefore holy as I am holy. Be ye therefore separate as I am separate. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. For God exalts the humble but sets a battle plan against the proud. Why is humility so important? Why is meekness so important? Well, we'll answer that on Sunday, but this plays into it. Idolatry in the temple. The shock of seeing this idol must have been completely unnerving for Ezekiel. Yet this is not the worst of it, believe it or not. God tells him, you're going to see more shocking things than this. Verse 7. He brought me to the entrance of the court. And when I looked around, there was a hole in the wall. And then he said to me, son of man, dig. Dig in the wall. And then he said to me, son of man, dig in the wall. So I dug in the wall, and behold, there was an entrance. And he said to me, go in. You know why? Because what you are about to see is so vast, so 360, so panoramic, that you can't see it from the outside looking in. You've got to step in to take a good look around. Where is this? In the temple. In the temple. What does he see? Well, he said, go in and see the vile abominations they are committing there. So I went in and saw. And there, engraved on the wall all around, was every form of creeping thing and loathsome beast, read unclean animals. And all the idols of the house of Israel, and before them stood 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel with Jaazaniah. Say that fast three times. Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them. Now, what is interesting about this is, who are these 70 men? Well, they're not the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a group of leaders that made up of 70, but that was later. They ruled Israel at the time of Jesus. This is long before that. But you might remember that Moses, when he needed help, consecrated 70 men to be his assistants. And then most likely that tradition continued in Israel. So the picture that we're seeing here are men who matter. These are probably the priests, the civil leaders, the men who were running the place, those who were in charge. These are the representatives of the people. And he sees 70 men, and they're in this room, and the walls, which the Bible so beautifully, it's the King James Version has never been topped in this verse. It calls them the chambers of imagery. It literally means the room full of pictures. One cannot help but make a connection with modern day pornography in the computer. In the way that this kind of sin has become so ubiquitous in our nation. So look at it. I went, I saw, and there engraved on the wall all around every form of creeping things and loathsome beasts and the idols of the house of Israel. And this, and before them stood 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel with Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them. And this is important because these are people of whom there is no sin recorded. The idea is that these are the people that other people looked to and said, that guy's godly. That's the man that if you want to know about God, go and talk to him. He can tell you about God. These are the priests. I want you to understand something, and we're going to see it from our time. It looks like we'll see it next week. But the priests stand between the altar. The altar is the altar where the animals are sacrificed. And God. I told you that holiness is proximity. That's what we're trying to prove in these many messages. And the idea is, at this time, in order for the people, God is over there. That's the yellow stool. This is the presence of God in the Holy of Holies. In order for Joe Turnip Picker of the tribe of Asher to get to God, I've got to go through this priest. The priest represents the people to God. And the priests are all corrupt. They're standing in this room filled with the chambers of imagery, the walls of pictures, completely corrupt. And they're the ones who are supposed to be leading people through the offerings to the presence of God. Like I said, just a light little softball message for a beautiful summer Wednesday evening. And besides that, each of these 70 elders, it goes on to say, had his censer in his hand. And the smoke of the cloud of incense went up. Talk about that in a moment. So the 70 men in the chambers of imagery, surrounded by all of these filthy pictures, are holding a pan, and on the pan is burning incense. Why? Why? What does incense represent? and something else. Prayer, incense represents two things in the Bible. I'll get to it in just a moment. Then he said to me, "Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the dark? Each in his own chamber of imagery, each in his own room of pictures. For they say," and by the way, they're wrong here, "but they say, the Lord doesn't see us." What I do in the privacy of my own home, I mean, after all, who knows? Who sees? Up Sunday morning, I'll be right there worshiping with the gang. Nobody knows. Wrong. To have that kind of mentality, my sin won't find me out. We're living in the days of anonymity. Are you, honest to God, are you stupid? If anything, we're living in a day where anonymity no longer exists. Every stinking click you make on your computer is recorded. Why? I have no idea. And you think you can escape the eyes of God? That is the heart of these 70 elders who were in the chambers of imagery with their fire pan, burning their incense, saying, you know why it's okay to do this? Because God doesn't see it. Oh, I think this is a picture of the church today. Oh, yes, I do. I think this is a picture of the church today. For they say the Lord, that and Yahweh, the Lord is Yahweh, right? It's all capital letters there. They use the divine name. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for God will not hold him guiltless who useth his name in vain. Never mind using his name in vain, using his name in blasphemy. Twice. For the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. And he said to me, what do you think of that, Ezekiel? You ain't seen nothing yet. You have not seen anything. You will see greater abominations still. What do you think? It's a pretty amazing passage, isn't it? So God led Ezekiel through the gateway to the entrance of the court. And in the hole in the wall, he tells him to dig, and he does. And he sees these 70 elders there, most likely all men who were in leadership capacity. And these were men who played important parts in the affairs of the state in the final years of Judah. Now, I mentioned the incense. Incense is almost always used to represent prayers. We find this in the book of Revelation. The prayers went up, you know, from the people of God. The idea, I think, of the table of incense was always right before the veil that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. And the idea was the prayers of God's people going up before the presence, you know. But there's one other thing that prayers were used for in the Bible. What is it? That what I say? Okay. Now that I know you're all paying attention. Is it unprofessional to take a nap in the middle of a sermon if you're the preacher? Yeah? Okay. So, I think I have this up here. Steve, do you have Leviticus. Yeah, put that up. In this passage, God instructs the priest to take a censer full of coals from the fire from the altar before Yahweh and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and he shall bring it inside the veil and put the incense on the fire before the Lord that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony so he does not die. In this passage, incense is not used for prayer. Incense is used for protection from the presence of God. Now, what does it mean in this context? I don't know. Is it talking about prayer? I don't think so. Because we know these men are certainly not praying to God. These men are all idolaters. It may be a blasphemous thing where they're, even though they're in the middle of their sin, even though they're in the middle of, you know, these blasphemous thoughts that God is not watching, even though they're in the middle of this idea that God has forsaken the land and they can basically do whatever they want and they will never be caught, they'll never be in trouble, they'll never be a problem. Maybe they're further blaspheming God by taking this incense with them and saying, you know what? This is my rabbit's foot. According to Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 12, as long as I got this burning, I will not die. I don't know. But that makes more sense to me than it has any, than that it has anything to do with prayer. Well, incense. God knew their hearts. And he explained to Ezekiel that the elders were seeking to justify their sin by saying that the Lord does not see us and the Lord has forgotten the land. The elders felt that what they did in these darkened chambers would escape God's notice. They thought that he was only some kind of petty god. And furthermore, he'd abandoned them. So they were courting other gods who may be able to protect them. The elders' attitude would also be eventually transmitted to the people. What began in the temple spread its way out throughout all of the land. And we're going to see that in 9:9. Ezekiel 9:9 is going to address this. The people's progression of idolatry went from an open display of idols to secret worship of those idols in the very shadow of the Almighty. And that's why we cannot divorce this teaching from the understanding of each believer being the temple of God. The priest is impure. The priest represents people before God. Who are the priests today? We are. We represent before God an army of one, ourselves. And if the vessel is polluted, if sin is dwelling there, the fellowship with God is clearly broken because God will not share his temple with an idol. You see where this is going and why it's so important. Verse 14, then he brought me to the entrance of the north gate of the house of the Lord. And behold, what did I see there? I saw women crying. Why? Were they crying because there was so much sin in the city? No. Matter of fact, those who were crying that there was so much sin in the city, in the next chapter, are going to be the only ones who survive. You say, so wait a minute, you mean you survived because you were crying? Yeah, because crying was the indication of the true and genuine heart that loved the Lord and hated the sin that had invaded the land. It wasn't the crying that saved them, it's the heart that made them cry. And they're weeping. Who are they crying for? Tammuz. Tammuz is the ANA, the ancient Near Eastern religions, counterfeit Christ. This is the way the worship of Tammuz worked, or Dumuzi, if you were a Sumerian, he was Dumuzi. Dumuzi, or Tammuz, was the son of a very important deity herself, Semiramis in Babylonian, and like I said, the names change, but the religion stays the same. But what happened was, right around the time that all the vegetation dies, they believed that Tammuz dies. And he goes into the netherworld, or into the heart of the earth, if you will. And while he's gone, the people weep. This is how they worship him. In sexual licentiousness, which parrots fertility. And in the weeping. So in the months where there is no vegetation, the people are weeping. And then all of a sudden, Dumuzi is resurrected from the dead right about the time things start to grow again. In some places, this resurrection was marked with human sacrifice. It's just a sprinkling for the May Queen. The sprinkling is the bleeding many times of a virgin, and the blood would go into the ground and what? Appease God. And there would be a fruitful harvest, and guess what? The tradition continued next year. Do you remember Shelley Jackson's great story, The Lottery? You had to read that in college, right? Or like that in any anthology. It's amazing. It's about, you know, they're talking about a lottery. There's going to be a lottery. We're going to have a lottery. Why do we have the lottery? And why do we still even do the lottery? I don't know. We do it. We've always done it. Why do we do the lottery? We've always done it. All right, get your ticket. Everybody's got their ticket. It's all folded up, and it's a short story. It's amazing. I can't believe that more of you haven't heard it. It's very, 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 very famous. It's in every anthology of American literature you're ever going to find. And they're all gathering around together, and they're, hey, how are you doing? I haven't seen you in a long time. Okay, where are you going? I'm going over to the lottery. You know, good thing. Why do we still do this lottery? Seems a little antiquated. The older folks, you know, they want us to keep doing the lottery, but I don't know. I kind of think the lottery's kind of stupid. And then at the end of the story, do you want me to tell you how it ends? Well, the one who wins the lottery opens it up, and there's a black mark on the paper, and they all stone her to death. Why do we still do that lottery? I don't know. We've always done it. It's what we do. Fertility cults. Mother Earth. Why not Father Earth? Because fathers don't give birth to children. Mothers do. Mother Earth has to be satiated. And depending on the culture, it can be anything from fruit to the death of an animal to the death of a human being. But it all has to do with this. We'll leave here. It's time. But do you see the things that God is seeing? You need to let it chill you. You need to let it get into your spine. You need to let it bother you as much as it would have bothered the prophet Ezekiel, because only then will you be able to make sense of the horrific judgment. It had polluted the entire land. And when God comes and judgment comes, you know what he does? He calls for 6 executioner angels. He says, come on, 6 of you. And they all have their smashing weapon in their hand. And he says, I want you to go and I want you to put a mark on those who have been groaning for Israel. And those who have not, well, we'll see next time. Father, thank you for your word tonight. We pray that you would allow us to hide these things in our hearts, take them seriously, use them as a reason to evaluate our own life, our own walk with you, Father, to cleanse our personal temple so that you may be pleased, so that you may use us the way you wanted to use priests, Father, that they would, people could look and see the glory of God in these men. May people see the glory of God in us, Father. They'll never see it in a corrupt vessel. They'll never see it in a vessel polluted with idolatry. We can say all the right things, do all the right things, but the authenticity and genuineness of our faith will be exhibited only through a pure life. We love you and praise you. Thank you for this night. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, questions, concerns, Bible questions, counseling needs, prayer requests. Are you guys waving or are you, no? All right. Hold the prayer request because we'll pray before we leave. Joan had her hand up first.